the midweek drive, zooming into the future and energized by the now.
George Edward Lodge, a name you may not be familiar with, but then again, you know, we will hopefully put that to rights because he's one of the most famous British taxidermists and indeed illustrators. And he will have a key connection with Horncastle for a few weeks, certainly from April the 5th, and to actually talk us through some of the aspects relating to George Edward Lodge and the George Edward Lodge Trust and how it relates to Horncastle in particular with respect to the Sir Joseph Banks Society. We're delighted to welcome from the Sir Joseph Banks Society the wonderful Paul Scott. How are you, Paul?
I'm all right, thanks, Alex. Thanks for inviting me to come along.
Well, it's great to connect with your good self, and one day we'll see you in the studio, no doubt. But let's talk about George Edward Lodge. I mean, I said he's a taxidermist, he's an illustrator. Is that too small a description of the awesomeness of the individual?
I'm afraid it is, yeah. He was, I would say, to round him up, one of the greatest naturalists, particularly concerning birds, ornithology and falconry. So just to go through, I suppose I ought to start at the beginning. He was born in 1860 in Horncastle, and his father was actually the headmaster of Horncastle Grammar School, and the Reverend Samuel Lodge. And George was born in the in Grammar School house, which still exists. A few years afterwards, George became the vicar of Scrivelsby, and they moved into a new parsonage that had been built on the estate. And he was to spend, his father was to spend many years there as parson. He was also sub-dean of Lincoln Cathedral, I think. But of course, Scrivelsby is an amazing place in terms of the park and the countryside. It's betwixt the fen and the wolds, really. And I can imagine George and his brothers growing up there and having a great time, you know, finding out about nature and birds and everything else that was around them. He went to Lincoln Art School, and I think that's the one that used to be on Lindham Hill, and he studied art there. And became a very accomplished artist. He then moved at some point in his life. He moved to just outside London, where he had a quite a nice old house and studio there. And he kept falcons, and he was really interested in falconry and all things birds, really, and anything else that came along. He taught himself woodcutting. So he was, and I don't mean a woodcutter in terms of chopping logs. I mean very fine work for woodcut illustrations, wooden blocks that were tiny, tiny little tools, and amazing. He illustrated loads and loads of books using those sorts of techniques, as well as hand painting, of course. He was a taxidermist, which you've mentioned. An excellent taxidermist, I might add, and but most of all, he was an artist, and possibly one of the most accomplished British artists in his genre. And certainly, his pictures nowadays are accumulating in value. He was quite a prolific painter, though. Surprising how many of them do come onto the market. Which is quite useful because you could actually gauge his rising popularity by the prices that his paintings.
So clearly a jewel in the crown of natural history as far as Britain is actually concerned. Could you share with us how the Sir Joseph Banks Society came to actually launch this exhibition, obviously with Kenneth Lodge? Because I think it was a little bit of good fortune, really, or perhaps it was fate, that actually saw Trustee Ken Richards effectively having chance encounter that opened this whole thing up.
He did, yes, he did. It was pure chance. It was one of those really rare things that happen in life where things just come together, and we find that around Joseph Banks actually all the time. Sort of David Robinson, our past president, unfortunately we lost him a few years ago. He used to say, all roads lead to Joseph Banks, and I think he's not quite he's not far off. But Lodge seems to be a pretty similar guy. You mentioned Lodge in lots of company, and you know you find people saying, "Oh yeah, we know Lodge, and we've got one of his pictures." Even people often say. So yes, Ken just happened to be at Louth Museum, which is just up the road from us, as you probably know. And he was talking to one of the curators there, and she said, "Oh, a chap's just been in asking about where he could deposit some of the George Edward Lodge collection." Well, Ken had heard of Lodge because Ken's really likes birds and things as well. So he'd heard of Bannerman and Lodge, the famous set of British birds. And so he instantly knew that there was quite a good connection there. So the lady gave Ken Brian's phone number, and he rang Brian. And I should say that Brian Bird is the curator of is the chairman of the George Edward Lodge Trust.
Very impressive surname, given, of course, the ornithology mentions that we talked about earlier. Really, so
appropriate, isn't it? Yeah, it's so appropriate. He once said to me, "I wish he had a pound every time somebody had said that." But anyway, so Ken rang him and he said, "I've been looking for a museum." And Ken said, "Well, did you know there was one in Horncastle?" And Brian, of course, we were so new that Brian had never heard of us. So the rest is history. He came over to see us. He thought that this would make an excellent home for the collection. He was looking to move the collection into a museum, and here was one in Lodge's hometown. So how good is that? And so Brian brought the collection up. This was last year, just after COVID, and we packed it away into a cupboard, quite a large cupboard. We packed it all away. And then decided that we would have our first major exhibition would be the Lodge exhibition. We kind of, I kind of called it from cupboard to case, which basically means we're going to take it out of the cupboard, we're going to put it in the case, we're going to have an exhibition.
That makes sense. Of course, the exhibition runs from the 5th of April to the 30th of June. The Sir Joseph Banks Society Visitor Centre is, of course, open on Thursdays, Fridays and Saturdays. It's really, is it a once in a lifetime thing? I'm tempted to think it is, actually, in terms of for Horncastle, actually, to have the prestige of actually hosting this exhibition. It's pretty impressive.
It is. No, it's not once in a lifetime. We will have a standing display of Lodge items. Okay. Perhaps what I didn't make clear is the George Edward Lodge Trust have donated their whole collection to us. And so it will be staying in the museum. So we will have a standing display, a permanent standing display, and we will rotate items through that display. We don't have enough room to have all of it permanently out. Sure. So as I say, we'll have a standing display that we rotate items through, and as and when we will bring some of the other objects out. We might also throw in here that where other museums want to borrow items from the Lodge Trust collection, we would look at that very carefully, and obviously we would try to accommodate that wherever we can. So we want to be good custodians of the collection. We want people to see it. We can't have it in a cupboard all the time. So we start with a three-month exhibition, then a rotating standing display, and as I say, we're happy to lend it out wherever it's appropriate to do that.
Seems a wonderful way to actually launch with Easter and then progress into at least early summer from that point of view. Of course, the news which we also can reveal for the Siren Radio listener is, of course, it's completely free admission, which is always a good thing to actually have, really.
It's free, yeah. I'm donations are welcome.
Of course.
We need to cover our overheads. So donations were gratefully received, really. But we kind of think that we're a new museum. We want people to know we're here. We don't want to put any barriers up, and quite clearly, we want loads of young people to come in as well. And to put a barrier up like £5 entry, so or £10 entry, which some museums charge, we don't think that's appropriate. So no, we're not going to do that. We're going to rely on people's generosity, and I mean, we can raise funds in other ways. So we will have merchandise and things like that.
Well, I think George Edward Lodge would be delighted with the fact that he's in the vanguard of this whole new exploration, as indeed will Sir Joseph Banks, basically, from that point of view. And people want to actually find out details online. What's the best way to actually go? Where would you suggest they should head if they're thinking of maybe coming to Horncastle from further afield?
In terms of finding us and the basic information about the exhibition, yes, online, which is www.joseph-banks.org.uk. We will be putting stuff out. In fact, we've already started putting stuff out on social media as well. So we've got a Facebook account and we have an Instagram account as well. So it will be on Twitter. So it will be going out quite a lot.
And Paul, I'm going to ask this question in any case, even though you might think, I can't possibly choose. Do you have a particular favourite exhibit which you think actually this is the thing I'm really pleased and proud to actually have in the Sir Joseph Banks Society Museum?
Well, I'll give you two for the price of one, really. Okay. Clearly, the personal items of George Edward Lodge, the tools that he used, his spectacles, his easel still with the paints on, his paintbrushes, those personal items that he used throughout his life, they're a joy to have, clearly. I think the real stunning standout object, though, is the painting, the local painting that people have never seen before, which is basically the sparrowhawk on a silver birch log. And it really does demonstrate the skill of Lodge. The silver birch shines off the canvas. It's that good. Well, and the setting and the way he's placed the bird and in a woodland scene is absolutely amazing. And, of course, the great thing is it's never been seen in public before. It was a private painting done for the family by Lodge. So that's just an amazing thing to have.
And it's strangely apt and somehow appropriate that actually the exhibition should take place in the town of his birth. So I think on that point of view, it's almost coming full circle to actually work through that. Paul, it's been fantastic sharing some thoughts with yourself today. I know there's so much more we can actually share about the museum, the Sir Joseph Banks Society and so on. I'm sure we will. But for the moment, huge thanks and good luck with the exhibition.
Thank you very much.
Okay, back in 2018, I think Greta Thunberg was saying that by 2023, the Arctic would have actually gone completely. That hasn't happened, but certainly things have happened with respect to the climate and its change or evolution. Remember, the planet isn't really worried about this. It's the life forms that exist on the planet that might have one or two challenges with respect to how nature is adapting to this. And to address the whole issue of climate change and maybe suggesting how high temperatures we had last summer could well become a thing of the future for a whole range of reasons. We're pleased to actually welcome the Chief Executive of the UK Climate Change Committee, that's CCC, and that's Chris Stark. How are you, Chris?
I'm very well. Thanks very much for having me on today.
Excellent. It's good to connect with your good self. But we saw, obviously, last year the first 40 centigrade degree day last summer. That certainly probably raised the issue of climate change. And you might well say, great, we need more of that to actually work through. But things are inevitably changing. And is that a case of, well, we've already passed the tipping point, so anything we're doing now is a bit like a elastoplast on a dam burst?
No, I think this idea that there's some sort of magical threshold that we must not cross is really one of the biggest fallacies in this area. I mean, we are seeing the change in the climate that's been long predicted, actually, for over 100 years. We knew this was coming, but it does feel very much, and I'm sure listeners will agree, that climate change is with us now. And the obvious sign of that, as you mentioned, was last year's very hot summer, 40 degree day. Now, It's not just about hot days. With that hot day, that hot period, we actually saw a really tragic statistic. We saw heat-related deaths in this country that were far in excess of anything we've seen before. That's basically old people, people who are infirm, people who are not well, in poorly ventilated buildings, healthcare settings. That's the kind of stuff that happens on the continent, and it's with us now. There was some surprise about that 40-degree day last year. It was ahead of schedule, but we knew it was coming. And with that change in the climate, with those hot weather periods, there's a lot more going on too. We see more extreme weather generally with climate change. That leads to things like flooding, deluge when it rains, and sure, listeners will recognise that, and wider impacts too, particularly around things like infrastructure. So these are things that we're all exposed to. You know, when we see an interruption to energy supplies when there's a major storm, that's a climate impact. You know, these are the kind of things that we need to be planning around. One of the messages we're giving to the government today is that they're just not taking this seriously. So we have a programme from the government, from DEFRA, which is designed to adapt our economy to the change in the climate. And, if you have the chance to look at it, you'll see that it's just not up to the mark. It doesn't really deal with the scale of the risks that we all now face. And this is about the things that people living in this country are now experiencing every single year.
We live in a global economy. Inevitably, people listening to this will say, yeah, what about the Bolsonaro Brazilian government and their deforestation of the Amazon? What about the jets that are being used where we could actually just stop overseas travel immediately? Why are we getting this sort of notion that we have to do some all bits when you've got these global issues that are occurring where people understandably perhaps get exasperated when you see international movements occurring and then people saying, I'm not going to sign up to that after all, basically.
Yeah, I mean, this is the most global of global goals. The underlying issue here is that as we burn fossil fuels, as we deforest, just as you made reference to in your question, we cause this issue of warming the planet. We're basically putting into the atmosphere effectively a blanket that keeps the planet warmer than it would otherwise be. And I'm afraid until we get to this global goal of net zero, that just means that we're putting as much into the atmosphere as we take out again. Until we get to that global goal, we will keep warming the planet. Now, on an optimistic framing, we might reach net zero by the middle of this century. If we do so, then the temperature targets that were set in Paris back in 2015, and which Boris Johnson was talking about in Glasgow back in COP26, you'll remember that a couple of years ago, then those temperature targets are in the frame. But we will keep warming the planet. Even if we're on that optimistic trajectory, we will keep warming the planet over the next couple of decades and potentially more. And that means that we've got to get to net zero. That means every country in the world has to do that. And happily, there's a good story now playing out that the alternatives to using fossil fuels look better and better each year, cheaper and cheaper. But still, we've also got to achieve net zero in the time of a warming climate. And that means that we've got to be prepared for more extreme weather, warmer summers, of course, droughts, water shortages with that. The idea that somehow the UK is insulated from that, I'm afraid, is just not true. So, of course, we are fortunate to be in a part of the world that is not going to experience the biggest extremes from climate change, but we still experience climate change. And these are major issues that impact on how we live our lives in this country. And one of the issues that's just not getting enough attention is how resilient we are to that here in the UK.
Mass migrations have obviously been a key factor in terms of economic upheavals and obviously times of war, etc. Do we need to go back to the time of Malthus and actually say that, yeah, we've got a situation where population is increasing geometrically, food production is only increasing arithmetically, so therefore we need to reduce the numbers of people on the planet?
No, I don't think we do. And I certainly hear that sometimes. But what matters is the what we call the carbon budget. That's basically how much carbon dioxide that we're responsible for individually. Now, what's interesting, if you look at the US or if you look at, for example, one of the Gulf states, then we have this enormous carbon budget per person living in those countries. If you go to somewhere like Bangladesh, tiny carbon budget per person. So actually what we've got to do is reduce it. That's the key thing. There is scope for us to live on this planet, but what we've been doing right now is living in a genuinely unsustainable way, unsustainable in every sense of that. This idea that we have to tackle it through population control, that's a pretty dystopian outlook on it, frankly. I think that the better approach to this is to live within our means, and that does not mean making major concessions to the way that we live our life, but it does mean planning ahead, putting in place the right strategies now that get us to net zero and also gets us to the point where we are resilient to the change in the climate that we can predict, I'm afraid, very accurately over the coming decades.
Yeah, I suspect the views of Elon Musk would simply be a case of, well, let's just go and terraform Mars and the heck with this planet, which, again, might be another sort of area to consider. Okay, the ccc.org.uk, Chris, is presumably the best place to go to find out further information about the nitty-gritty of these recommendations and so on. Are there any other sort of suggestions you'd like to make at this stage?
Yeah, I mean, that's an excellent suggestion. So that's the website for my organisation. We're the UK's climate advisors. We're independent of government. So, you know, there's a level of trust there for those of you who may have some suspicions about the present government or future government.
Surely not. I can't believe that.
But there are plenty of good resources out there too. I would very much recommend the Met Office's website as well, which is some excellent resources on the kind of change in the climate that we will experience across the country. And there are a host of other online pieces of information that you can use, which my website will help you navigate towards. Do have a look if you're interested at all in this, and do make sure that local elected representatives, be that at local government or national government, they need to know about this too, because in the end, that's what we really need. Individual action, of course, is important here, but we need government to put their arms around this, put the right policies in place, get us prepared and resilient to the change in the climate that's coming.
And given the suggestion that we can look forward to much wetter summers but milder winters, I mean, allowing for a milder winter we've just relatively recently had, I suspect a number of people in the energy crisis frame would have been quite grateful for that, really. So I was saying, is there a case for we're still getting people who will say, yeah, well, actually, it's not all that bad?
Yeah, I mean, listen, it was a mild winter this year. I have no confidence that we can predict the weather for next winter. It is true that we get this warming overall, but I'll tell you now that the impacts overall of climate change are profoundly negative. They are profoundly costly to society, profoundly costly to the economy. And it's much better all round if we tackle those early. So, you know, it's kind of confidently predicting that somehow a warmer winter makes it worthwhile. I'm afraid that's not the case. If you look at things like food production, agriculture, the droughts that we'll experience, major impacts from extreme weather, these are very expensive things. Actually, quite difficult to put a single number on it, given the size of the costs involved. So the sooner we tackle these things with early action, the better.
And given your former occupation as Director of Energy and Climate Change in the Scottish Government, were there any moments, Chris, when you sort of thought, I just shrugged my shoulders, I just give up, basically, I'm going to actually go independent on this one? I mean, we talked about the cynicism of government. Did you find that there was a sort of concern there when you were actually part of the government?
Well, I've worked in several bits of government. I had a very happy first decade of my career in Whitehall, and then the next part of my career in Scotland, working for the Scottish Government, under the now departed Nicola Sturgeon as First Minister. And listen, governments of all flavours have their rough edges. I mean, I have to say, in this country, on the issues that I cover on climate change, we have the right institutions in place. We have the right laws in place. What we're not seeing from government, though, is the action that's required under those laws. That's our job. My job in the Climate Change Committee is to highlight the failings of government when it comes to this. Sadly, on the issues that we're covering today about how well adapted we are to climate change, how resilient we are to climate change, I think this is probably the biggest failing of all for government. And the main reason for that is that politics doesn't like to confront these truths. We have climate change with us right now, but over the coming decades, that gets much worse. You get this symptom of not in my term of office, NIMTO, and we cannot have that. So we need politicians today to act on this so that we, in the future, are better prepared for the change in the climate.
Wow, Chris, you're arguing for deeds, not words, which is astounding, but never mind. Chris Stark, Chief Executive of UK Climate Change Committee, CCC, of course, huge thanks, and keep on keeping on.
Thank you.
All right, let's look at some figures which may make you do a double take, effectively. 31% of people buy a bottle of water on long journeys, and 6 in 10 of us, 61%, say they'd be less likely to buy a bottle of water if there were more refill stations. When we actually acknowledge that there are some substantial challenges when it comes to plastic in the ocean and beyond, clearly we need to look at this finding by Yonder. So we're delighted to welcome the co-founder of Ocean Bottle to explain some of the aspects of this. That's Will Pearson. How are you, Will?
Hey, Alex. How are you doing? Thanks so much for having me on the show.
Excellent. Well, I mean, these survey results, most people, in fact, nearly three quarters of us own a reusable water bottle, but they can't fill it, so they have to buy a plastic one. I mean, we need to be hydrated, but clearly, you know, the solution seems to be we need more refill stations, don't we?
Yeah, you know, it's kind of crazy, but actually we recently found, the first stat we found was that London has fewer refill points, public refill stations than ancient Rome. And this really kind of made us question, well, you know, what on earth is actually going on here? So the UK on the whole spends £1.2 billion a year on water that is wrapped in plastic bottles, generating about 7.7 billion plastic bottles worth of waste. So yeah, it's a huge problem. And unfortunately, you know, loads of people have a reusable bottle. They want to try and do something about this, but it's really, really difficult because everywhere you go, there's a kiosk on the corner where you can buy bottled water and part with your pounds. But there is really, you know, very, very few places to refill. So yeah, we really want to change that.
I suspect you're too young to remember the time when people were saying, sell water, sell bottles water, Perrier must be mad, it's insane. But of course, it's a multi-billion pound industry from that point of view. I mean, Ocean Bottle is trying to combat this, though. I mean, you've had huge success. I mean, you've got over 35 folk in the company. You're growing year on year at a rate of 300% year on year. So clearly you're doing something correctly and something absolutely spot on. Do you feel as though this ambition of actually reducing our reliance on plastic, in particular plastic water bottles, is an achievable target in the next few years?
Well, yeah, I mean, well, thank you, Alex, firstly. And I think, yeah, anything's possible if we set our mind to it. I mean, we sent someone to Mars. Sorry, not Mars yet, the moon. And well, Mars is looking possible. So yeah, anything is possible. I think if we set our minds to it. So yeah, with Ocean Bottle, we really kind of started out with a simple goal. So we kicked it off a couple of years back. I'm 28 years old, and yeah, so really we wanted to make it possible for individuals to actually have a global impact on the ocean plastic crisis. That was really, really why we started it. It was around the time of Blue Planet 2. Mm. And so what we did was, so we created the Ocean Bottle, which is what we call the world's most needed reusable bottle. You'll have to decide for yourself. But every single bottle that we sell funds collection equivalent to 1,000 plastic bottles in weight in impoverished coastal communities around the world. So we actually set up collection points for plastic in Indonesia, the Philippines, in India, Ghana, Kenya, all over the world, and enable people to actually exchange their plastic for money, but also other social benefits. So today, yeah, we fund a collection of just over 8 million kilograms of plastic, really much thanks to the community of people who own our reusable bottles and are involved. And our goal is, you know, is to do much, much more. So we're really just getting started. So that's kind of what we're doing as an impact company. But obviously our hope, you know, alluding to kind of your question, Alex, which is, you know, can we really get people to refill these bottles every single day and actually get rid of the plastic water bottle? You know, that's also something that we're very, very keen to do and something that we think is possible with the right support from, you know, governments in different countries. So here in the UK, there's no reason why, you know, we couldn't have as many refill stations as we had post boxes, you know, Royal Mail post boxes. If you, you know, go to any corner from your house, almost you'd find a post box somewhere. You know, there's no reason we can't have a similar network, which not only will benefit people's wallets and mean that people don't have to spend money on bottled water, but also have a huge positive impact for the environment. I mean, refilling emits almost 100 times less CO2 than buying bottled water.
And presumably, at present at least, drinking water costs a lot less than a first-class stamp, but that's another issue entirely.
Absolutely.
If we're looking in terms of ways in which we can support Ocean Bottle, where would you point the listener to this particular program? Where would you suggest they should go?
So yeah, if you'd like to learn more about what we're doing as a company, but also if you'd like to get involved with this campaign that we're running, please just head to oceanbottle.co, which is our website, or you can go to @oceanbottle to visit our Instagram, which is also possible.
Well, I did say we'd talk about some eye-watering figures, but UK consumers going through an estimated 14 billion plastic drinks bottles per year, with over half of those being bottled water. So that's 7 billion bottled water plastic bottles. Clearly, that's an awful lot of plastic to be dealt with. And hopefully what you're doing will be more than just a drop in the ocean, Will. But for the moment,
yeah, well,
Will Pearson, co-founder of Ocean Bottle, keep up the excellent work.
Thank you so much, Alex. Thank you for having me.
Well, if I said the words bi-directional charging to you, you might think, what an unusual concept to actually bring to the fore. But apparently it is the way forward, or could be the way forward, when it comes to electric vehicles. So to explain how Indra have actually come up with this whole notion of bi-directional charging and how it can actually reduce electricity bills, we're delighted, of course, to welcome that saviour of the budget in so many ways. It's Harry Wallop. How are you, Harry?
I'm very well, thank you, Alex.
Excellent. So, I mean, let's go straight to the definitions to start off with. What exactly is bi-directional charging?
Well, indeed, yeah, it is quite a mouthful, but it's quite an easy concept in some ways. It's, you need to think of your car, your electric car, as a sort of mobile battery, as a storage unit for electricity. So what you can do is you can charge up your car when electricity is cheap, which is invariably in the middle of the night. And it's cheap because there's no demand, because everyone's asleep and they don't need to charge up their kettles or fire up their ovens. So you charge up your car in the night when it's cheap. And then the bi-directional bit is, well, when there is huge demand for electricity, so typically that's in the afternoon when the kids come home from school and they open the fridge and they turn on the games console. So there's always a huge surge in demand for electricity in the UK at around about 5 p.m., 6 p.m., 7 p.m. Well, at that moment, what you could do is your fully charged car that's sitting on your front driveway, that could send electricity back to your house, potentially saving you money. So that's the idea. Your car is essentially a portable, huge electricity storage battery that could actually power up your home or indeed any other building.
Well, again, one of the lines that we've often heard is that if a deal sounds too good to be true, it may be too good to be true. You are obviously our key consumer specialist. I mean, this sounds ideal, but are there any catches in terms of this, Harry?
Well, I mean, so this has been talked about for a couple of years and it has worked. We know it's worked in various trials. Indra is one of the companies doing it. Their trials have worked. The issue is that the charging units themselves are likely to be quite a bit more expensive than your typical EV charging units. If you've got an electric car and you have one of those charging units that allow you to charge up from your home, you'll know it'll cost at least 500 quid up to around about £1,000. And these are likely to be a bit more expensive than that. So you are going to have an upfront cost. And you're also going to have to make sure that your house is compatible. And not all houses necessarily are, because this whole sort of sending electricity back to the house is quite technical. Obviously, engineers will do this for you. And obviously, it hasn't rolled out yet. We're just in trial phase yet. So we don't know whether this could, you know, sweep across the country or whether it's just always going to remain a niche thing.
Indra have obviously released their vision for 2033. That's 3 years after petrol vehicles, effectively the sale of new petrol and diesel vehicles has been banned. Do you feel as though this is a realistic way in which we can approach the next decade? And yes, if we look ahead through our magical time machine, every home will actually have a portable charging pack or transporting device, which also feeds electricity back into the home environment.
Well, I think what's most exciting in some ways is not actually this as an option to charge up your car, though it is a considerably cheaper way than charging up your car. Or at least the idea of charging up your car in the middle of the night is a far cheaper way than just going to the garage and charging it up there. What I think that why this technology, why bi-directional charging is so exciting, is the concept that it could harness electricity. Because what we have a lot of people who are moaning at the moment. Sorry, but they are moaning that sustainable electricity isn't really sustainable. So we're talking here wind turbines and solar panels, and they go, oh, well, Britain's not very sunny. Well, no, it's not very sunny. The sun doesn't shine in the middle of the night. Oh, and it's only sometimes windy. And that is true. It is only sometimes windy. And what we have, though, we have these wind turbines going for hell for leather when it's a windy day, but we can't necessarily use all that electricity. We've got nowhere to store it because storage batteries are in their very early infancy and they're outrageously expensive. So no one's really cracked storage batteries. If our cars could become thousands, hundreds of thousands of little storage batteries all around the country who are able to capture this cheap, sustainable electricity, then that just changes the entire energy market. We suddenly no longer are in an energy crisis. We have access to cheap electricity. So that's why I think it's really exciting. It's not just exciting for electric vehicle drivers. It's exciting for all of us.
We've spoken about obviously charging your vehicle at night, but I can already hear people saying, what about shift workers? What about people who actually work at night and need their cars to actually go out and about then? Will there be a kind of daytime equivalent?
Well, that's a fair question, actually. I mean, at the moment, if you look at your typical petrol car costs £74 to fill. Mine's quite a bit more than that, but let's put me aside. That's £74. A typical electric car is £21 to charge up. And that's just from a public charging point. And that's sort of the average for a same size vehicle. So it is a lot cheaper, even at peak times. If you charge it up on one of these special tariffs, and a couple of electricity companies do have special EV charging tariffs where you charge up in the night, it goes down to £7. So someone who had to charge it up during the day, you are missing out on super cheap electricity, but it's still a lot cheaper than petrol. So, it's not the end of the world.
The survey did reveal that nearly half of drivers are worried about the environmental impact of petrol and diesel cars. 31% feel guilty about driving them. But as you pointed out there, Harry, 59% overestimates the cost of charging an EV. Has that also been driven by the fact that we literally just saw energy prices go through the roof and people said, oh, well, there we are. Electricity is not going to be any cheaper when you're actually driving your car as well.
Well, I think that's that's an excellent point, Alex. And I think this Indra survey is quite interesting. People do have slightly muddled concept of electric cars. And they are correct that they are, electric cars are more expensive than a petrol car. There is no doubt about that. But the charging up, I think there have been a couple of scare stories about, oh, how expensive it is to charge up an electric car. And it can be very pricey if you go for super fast charging, on a charging point on one of the main motorways. I think, the typical charge isn't that expensive. But no, there is no doubt about it. And the Indra survey does make it clear people are worried about the price of an electric car. Only 30% say they would buy one in the next year. And, considering the government is going to ban petrol and diesel cars within the next 7 years, then that is interesting that people are still very reluctant to move over to electric.
It's enough to make you go back to the horse and carriage and the stagecoach, but maybe that's another retro view for another time, basically. Where can people find out more details, Harry, about this Indra survey and indeed the Indra opportunities for 2033?
Yeah, if you just go on to www.indra, which is INDRA, .co.uk, they're a British company and they've got all their details online. You can find out all the details there.
And from your own perspective, Harry, are you available on the usual socials?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter, H Wallop.
There you are, Harry Wallop, consumer expert extraordinaire. Not as yet, I believe, an owner of an electric vehicle, or is that something you're going to be changing soon, Harry?
Well, this is interesting. No, I'm not. I'm your typical. I would love to have an electric vehicle. I genuinely would, for all sorts of reasons, not just because I want to help the planet, for selfish reasons as well. I think, I like to future-proof myself. But when I went to look at one a couple of years ago, they were a lot more expensive than, a second-hand petrol car. So I'm holding on. But my local neighbourhood in London, they are building a lot more charging points in my street. So it's starting to become a bit more of a viable concern.
Well, there you go. Although I'm never quite sure with respect to the current occupant of the mayor's office in London in terms of whether they want any people coming in from London at all, basically. But that's another line entirely. Harry Wallop, consumer commentator extraordinaire. Huge thanks. And keep on saving us money, Harry.
Thanks very much indeed, Alex.
£28 billion, significant number and significant figure. And that was the amount that was lost last year due to poor mental health at work. 23 million working days have been lost. And if we actually want to find out something that the United Kingdom is way ahead of other countries in, it's certainly those people who are struggling or languishing in their work environment. Burnout, of course, springing to mind. So how can we actually begin to address this? How can we actually improve the overall quality of our work? Well, we've got two fine folk to talk about the whole essence of this challenge. First of all, the Chief Executive Officer of AXA UK, that's Claudio Ginal. How are you, Claudio?
Morning, I'm really well.
Excellent. And we've got ace champion extraordinaire, Team GB Paralympian, it's Amy Conroy. How are you, Amy?
What an intro. I'm well, thank you.
Excellent. Amy, I'm going to turn to you first because sports people are frequently turned to in terms of, yeah, you know how to actually cope with burnout. You know how to cope with pressure. You can tell the rest of us where we're going wrong. So were you surprised by these findings?
I mean, I feel like often we see kind of people when they're standing there all happy with their medals and you see the social media glory snippets. But equally, I've absolutely struggled loads of times, had many tough times. So I think seeing one in five people, it does stand out as being more than I'd think. But equally, the fact that we're sharing that awareness now, I think that's important. I think knowledge of knowing other people are also going through tough times makes it easier for you to speak out if you are and not be ashamed. That like, vulnerability is not a weakness in any way.
I mean, how did you actually cope when the pressure was on, Amy? Because clearly that's one of the key aspects of this. I mean, what was your response? Did you go to a quiet place? Did you have a specific routine? What were those sort of areas you adopted?
I have dabbled with many different ways. Some ways have flopped terribly and didn't work for me at all. So I think it's not a one-size-fits-all approach. So I think knowing yourself is really important. I've been fortunate enough to have a brilliant dad who all through kind of, one had cancer, losing a leg, first trying wheelchair basketball and being hopeless but having these big dreams. He was the one who kept me on track, you know, helping me remember that, you know, life will always have tough times, but it's up to you to kind of hold yourself accountable, not let yourself get away with excuses and settling and pushing yourself. And I know sometimes that can be really tough and it's a lot easier said than done, but you are worth that effort. And that's what this study in the Mind Health Meter is trying to push.
And clearly that's at the heart of the whole process. I mean, I think, whilst we obviously have sympathy with Nicola Sturgeon and Jacinda Ardern, et cetera, they haven't had to cope with the kind of challenges you've been faced with. And many people don't, in a sense, thankfully. So, you know, I'm thinking about obviously rising to the challenge. Let's turn to Claudio, if we may. Claudio, were you surprised by these findings? Do you think as though, you know, okay, as I said, UK top of the table in one sense, or national table in the other, it's all down to perspective.
Yeah, well, it's not a surprise. We have done this now for 3 years in a row, and the UK tends to be at the lower end when it comes to people struggling. And as you say, it's one in five. There's also some positiveness in here. The one is that there's less stigma in the UK than in other countries. You have 55% of people think this is something we can talk about, and that might be one of the reasons why we see slightly higher numbers. And the other thing is also that in the UK, a lot of parents think it's worthwhile discussing mental health with kids, which again is a very big positive. As a father of two, I think that's where it starts. But overall, not surprised, but it also shows there's quite some work in front of us.
Amy, were you surprised from your own point of view in terms of the gender split and the aspect of that? Or is it a case of, well, it's understandable, women have much more stress overall than men?
I think the main thing that stood out for me was that 18 to 24-year-olds, nearly half would say that they're struggling with negative mental health, and this study suggests it's through to kind of societal expectations, body image, tech addiction, and it's just these are the types of things which we can help and control. So it just seems more powerful that we've got that knowledge now to start kind of doing what we can to help combat that.
Are there any particular suggestions you'd put forward in terms of actually coping with these stressors?
I think with social media, it can definitely do good as well as harm. For me, I'd use it through kind of, I think role models are really powerful inspirations. When I first lost my leg, I hadn't seen anyone with one leg before kind of doing much. There wasn't social media really then. So I think seeing other people achieve things can help give you that boost. Think if they can, why can't I? However, equally, I try to be quite aware of how I feel when I notice something's on social media. And just like kind of it's all the rage right now to notice negative energy in person and kind of distance yourself from that. I think also that with social media, if you're seeing things which you do kind of feel a bit low after it, distance yourself from that. And just healthy daily habits, even if you start really small, things that are going to be noticeable changes, I think is something that's helped me and I'd recommend.
So avoiding doom scrolling would be a key thing.
Yes, get rid of the negative vibes that you can control.
Okay, Claudia, where can people find out more about this research and areas with respect to it?
Yeah, so basically you can find this on the AXA UK's website, Helping Minds Flourish webpage.
And in terms of following your good self on the social media format, Amy, how can people sort of follow the adventures of Amy Conroy?
I'm on Instagram as AmyConroy10.
Fantastic. Amy Conroy, GB Paralympian extraordinaire, and Claudio Ghino, Chief Executive Officer of AXA UK. Huge thanks. And keep on keeping on.
Thank you.
Thank you. Have a good day.
The fourth biggest killer in the United Kingdom, strokes. Yes, strokes. More than 100,000 people suffer a stroke each year. So how can we minimise the danger, minimise the risk, and how can we act fast to actually address the whole thing? Well, we're delighted to actually welcome a fine soul who's going to explain all the key aspects that we need to be aware of with respect to the FAST campaign. And that's, of course, the wonderful Dr. Sarah Kayat. How are you, Sarah?
Hi, thank you so much for having me on.
Okay, so it's great to connect with your good self. And obviously, when we start talking about strokes, this is something we hope is never going to happen to us or indeed our loved ones. But of course, it could do. And the chances of actually surviving from a stroke can be really critical when it comes to the Act Fast campaign.
Exactly. So this campaign highlights that, firstly, stroke is a medical emergency, and you do need to call 999 immediately if you notice any single one of the signs of stroke in yourselves or in others. And the next step of this campaign is to highlight those symptoms. So it's the Think and Act Fast campaign, and the FAST is an acronym. So F is for face. Has their face fallen on one side? Can they smile? A is for arms. Can they raise both arms and keep them there? S is for speech. Is their speech slurred? And T is for time. Even if you're not sure, call 999 immediately.
I mean, allowing for the whole aspect of that, surviving a stroke, as I said at the start, Sarah, is this something which is important, that it is a case of if we take those immediate prompt actions, even though we may not be medically trained, we can at least hopefully alleviate the symptoms and alleviate the subsequent problems?
We know that delayed action can result in death and long-term disabilities like paralysis, memory loss, communication problems. So yes, prompt recognition of the symptoms and acting fast really does ensure that people who are having a stroke get emergency treatment earlier, which then goes on to give them the best chance of survival and recovery.
I was intrigued to see that the data from NHS England so shows that 39% of people don't recognise a stroke as a medical emergency, that it requires immediate attention. And indeed, a fifth are not confident that they could recognise typical signs of a stroke. I mean, I thought we'd actually got over that hump when it came to public information. But clearly, the very fact that you're on air with us today is proof that we need to continue raising the awareness of this challenge.
Absolutely. I was shocked at seeing those statistics as well, to be completely honest with you. And I think we know that awareness raising campaigns are really vital parts of NHS work, and raising awareness of the signs of stroke and the need to seek medical help straight away will give people the best chance going forward.
Is there a location you would point people to actually provide more information about how to actually cope, and particularly that FAST acronym?
Yes, absolutely. So the NHS website, the www.nhs.uk/actfast, will provide you with more information.
And in your professional career, Sarah, has that been any? Have you had to deal with stroke victims? Have you had this crisis that's occurred yourself and put the FAST into action?
I certainly have when I worked in A&E, absolutely. So we saw a lot of strokes coming through, sadly, but they were in the right place by that point, and we were able to offer the appropriate treatment. I haven't yet, just on my daily shop in the Tesco, seen anyone, so I haven't had to put it into action in that kind of way, but in medical settings, yes.
Yeah. Well, again, hopefully the whole FAST thing. Let's just go through that acronym once again. I mean, for people who actually may still have actually been a bit confused, et cetera. F, of course, stands for face.
Face. Has their face fallen on one side? For example, can they smile? A is for arms. Can they raise both arms and keep them there? S is for speech. Is their speech slurred? And T is for time. You know, call 999 immediately.
Sarah Kyatt, many thanks indeed. Keep on keeping on and keep up the excellent work.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
I think it was Aretha Franklin who had a hit with R-E-S-P-E-C-T, and certainly respect for individuals is critical when we look at the dating game. Why? Well, because basically you don't want to have substandard dating behaviour. In fact, if you actually endure substandard dating behaviour, which can be anything from ghosting through to all sorts of other areas, maybe you need to call that out. How can we actually address this Plenty of Fish survey? Well, by the fantastic work of author and life coach extraordinaire Michelle Ellman. How are you, Michelle?
Hi, thank you so much for having me on.
Well, it's always great to get to connect with your good self. Were you surprised, of course, Michelle, by the findings of this survey in which 3/4 of the single public are determined to have a spring clean of their dating regime?
Yeah, I was actually finding it really promising. The fact that so many people, 54% of people, feel comfortable calling out undesirable dating behaviours is just really encouraging as someone who talks about boundaries so much, that people feel confident to set those boundaries, stand up for themselves, and say no to substandard dating behaviour.
We talked about some of the examples of that, one being stood up on a date. That's always been a kind of issue, I suppose, where people have been annoyed about that. 21st century, of course, being ghosted without explanation, literally just being ignored. That's quite upsetting. And, of course, the unfortunate notion of receiving unsolicited nude pictures. Not yes. Big, not clever in so many ways.
I think it's one of those cliches of if you wouldn't do it in person, don't do it online. And it's illegal to do it in person, and it's now becoming illegal to do it online. And I just think if you dated enough, you've experienced most of these. I've personally experienced most of these. And when it comes to things like ghosting, it's cruel, it's unkind, and we need to be okay to have those hard conversations. It's not particularly pleasant to tell someone you're not interested in them, but it's much better to tell them to their face than leave them guessing and wondering whether you're still interested or not interested. It's about that clarity. And if you want someone to communicate with you, it has to start with you first.
There's an old notion of, the Hindu line of namaste, recognizing the positive in other people as you recognize the positive in yourself. Maybe before you can go to that stage, you need to ensure that your inner positivity is being as positive as it can be, perhaps.
Absolutely. I always say be the behavior you want to see. So that is in the same line, in the same vein.
And allowing for that, if we're looking at doing that spring cleaning, is it just a case of exercising regularly, getting more sleep, prioritizing self-care, all the kind of things which we sort of know are important, but somehow, I don't know, we maybe put them to one side?
Well, I think my area of expertise is life coaching, obviously. And so I found it really positive to know that 77% of people are actually working on themselves. And they do believe, 82% do believe it does lead to greater dating success and also greater self-awareness. Because I always say, like, you should ask yourself the question, would you date you? And it tends to spotlight the areas that you can work on.
We live in a global culture, global environment. Are there any indications from Plenty of Fish survey that, you know, people from different countries are better or worse at these aspects than others?
We very much focused on British singles. So we asked 4,000 people in this country. So we focused on that. But I think all of these experiences are worldwide. I think ghosting, catfishing, nasty comments are things that people are experiencing in their dating life. Because realistically, whether it was happening in person or on a dating app, it's just society. And so by having safeguards on these apps, like Plenty of Fish has with this, are you sure? So if you send anything that's vaguely rude or has a rude word or even a rude emoji, it pops up with "Are you sure?" to make sure people have that consciousness about thinking about before what you say.
And allowing for that, I mean, it's interesting that about almost half of those in the dating field claim that unpleasant behaviour makes them doubt they'll ever meet someone. And indeed, over a third said their confidence was negatively impacted. I mean, this is not just being overly sensitive. It is a case of if somebody is actually sort of being aggressive or rude or ignoring people, it doesn't really do much for the psyche, does it?
No, and I think you have to remember that it's not a reflection of you. That this, I mean, the encouraging thing I found is that because it's happening so often, you're not alone. You're not the only person going through it. And what I believe is if you're ghosted, for example, that person's ghosted before. They might ghost again if they don't have self-awareness, but it's not because of you. It's not personal. Because either way, if they were interested or not interested, they could have communicated that. And that's on them. Their bad communication skills is something that they can own. And you don't have to own that. And you don't have to be ashamed that you got ghosted.
What's the classic, what goes around comes around, sometimes works to people's advantage. Do you feel that there's a kind of dating karma that occurs as well?
Well, I don't know about that, but what I do know is that it's a gift when they ghost me, because I'd rather know sooner than later if they can't communicate. Because I also think someone who ghosts is also going to be someone who's going to be difficult to communicate with longer term in a relationship. So it's showing, they're showing you their behavior up front, and it's your job to listen to it.
Where can people find out further details about the Plenty of Fish survey, Michelle?
So you can find Plenty of Fish's Desirable Dating Guide on www.blog.pof.com.
And in terms of your own social media presence, I don't know if you've gone into TikTok videos as yet, but do you have any ways in which people can follow your good self?
I do have a TikTok and an Instagram at michellelelman.com, because it's a social media handle.
There you go, Michelle Elman, author and life coach extraordinaire. Delighted to connect with your good self once again. And keep on keeping on.
Thank you.